In this podcast, I'm going to cover the two stories of ozone. The first story that you're familiar with, because everyone knows it, is a story I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. It's the story of the scientific heroes that discovered the hole in the ozone layer, worked out that it was people's spray cans and refrigerators causing it. They had the Montreal Protocol banned it, and the planet was averted from disaster. That's one story, and that's basically the story. The second story I'm going to tell is a story of ozone being perhaps the biggest scientific disaster that has ever befallen us. This is something that, just looking at the facts early on, I thought this is the disaster in the making. And as I've watched over the years, it's unfolded to this big disaster. And this is a disaster of science using up its credibility, taking a few shortcuts with its trusted public, in which if they reviewed what was going on, they'd lose trust in us. And then when the big... more complex problems come along, we are sort of powerless, and that's actually unfolded. So this particular explains where I discuss things scientific. Before I suppose basically ozone is O3, oxygen with an extra oxygen atom stuck to it, and it has the effect of screening out some of the sun's most harmful rays. Well, not the they're sunburn rays, so I'll discuss that a bit later on. And so it's in the atmosphere. I'll have a bit of a discussion with it. And what I'm going to do is give you a feeling of how I've experienced, and it's going to be in reverse order. One of my most recent experiences is when I was in the staff room at Blackson High, the local high school, as a newbie teacher. More experienced teacher said to me, you're supposedly got a molecular physics PhD, tell us a bit about ozone. And I said, ozone's in a broad band about 10 kilometres to 70 kilometres high, well, 20 to 75 around that, and peaking around 50 kilometres high, and I didn't get that very far. And he said, what? The ozone layer is a layer. It's sort of like a paint layer or an oil layer. It's called the ozone layer. And I said, okay. And he said it's exactly 3 millimetres thick, way up above the etc. And he began explaining things the way that he'd been taught, teaching it to his kids for the last umpteen years, and it all makes sense. Ozone layer, it's easy to teach that way because people, I think you put on a layer of clothing, so the ozone layer is a layer of atmosphere, which is like clothing or a blanket, so to speak. And I said, whatever you want. Yeah, I wasn't there to lecture or anything. I was just providing information. And he then went over to the internet, these old computers. So if you can remember computers before flat screens, those old cathode ray, thick, heavy monitors with the heating at the outside. And he looked over it and he looked at the diagram and saw that what I was saying was, in fact, correct. He lost his temper like anything and shouted and slammed the side of the screen. And he said he was angry at me and also angry at scientists and the internet for misleading him. And it was quite a frightening experience. So I thought I'd start with the most frightening experience, and he stormed out. But then later on, I found out that he was continuing to teach this ozone layer, a thin layer. And so that was a bit of a profound view. And I suppose that's the way of telling you the first fact about ozone. The ozone layer is actually a zone in the atmosphere in which ozone is quite common. This is O3. And it's up above the weather, the troposphere, obviously starting into the stratosphere. And we'll discuss that a little bit more. But that's the first thing, what I think is the ozone disaster, our disaster in actually educating people and building a professional relationship with society. We've more a theatrical relationship with society, scientists, and so it leaves open to people who want to spruik science reading the wrong thing, and they're not necessarily the most cool-headed people who are doing this. They're not, and it took me a while to work out what did I see and what's the process. And upon reflection, I think. When people lose temper and do that sort of things, they're actually, although you and I can't understand it, they are actually thinking in a funny sort of way, and thinking in a funny sort of way actually doesn't advance or change their thinking. So, look, that's the best I can explain it. Now, I said it's reverse order. A fair number of years before I was in Canada, in Toronto, up in the electrical engineering department, and looked out the window, and in Bloor Street, I saw none other than David Suzuki walking past. I knew he was a key person to tell people about the ozone layer and the effect, and I ran down to him and I said, look, we've got to do a bit. You and I are scientists. We've got to do a bit better explaining this ozone layer. So, you know, in years to come, there's someone who's got an even worse explanation. But at this stage, I said, oh, did you know the majority of Canadians I speak to believe that the ozone hole is directly above them in Toronto? And he said, well, that was a David Suzuki. I was much nicer to him, but I didn't have time. He was just walking in the street, and I was this person. And he said, no, that's not true. No Canadians would believe that. And I said, well, let's stop. Let's do an experiment. And I stopped 1, 2, 3 Canadians all on a row, and they said exactly that. The ozone hole was directly above them. That's partly because it was being reported in, I've got the CBC there, radios were reporting it. So I had heard a number of people say that. So that's not true. And I said, well, we have to do something about it. And he didn't quite shrug his shoulders, but I was another crazy person, crazy world. So I sort of, my reflection on that is that it's really hard to actually pick out or get the feedback about what people believe and understand going through. And I suppose from that, I thought we should actually do surveys of what people believe and actually do a closed loop, you know, what people hear and what they believe and what they should believe, sort of a basic educational testing as a guide. So if we are educating society, we actually test society and see the gap and approach scientific communication a bit more scientifically. Now, subsequent to that, there's been people doing large surveys of the United States, you know, the number of people who believe that the moon is travelling through the sky, or the number of people who don't understand basic things, and there's this guffaw at the ignorance of a large ignorance of our overall population who are voting and making decisions, but they don't understand basic science. My vision for this wasn't quite connected. It's come across, and people, it's more lightweight news rather than people saying, okay, well, we're going to have science funding on how to science communication, and evidence-based science funding for science communication, sort of a scientific approach to the way that we scientifically communicate. That's one episode, and I said there were three episodes, but going backwards in time. And you can sort of see this going backwards in time. The first time I began to sort of read... So that's basically what happened is I did a bit of my PhD research into another layer above the ozone layer, and just naturally read papers, and they had no agenda to them, and concluded that some of the communication was not right about ozone. I was sort of fairly passive, but I had my Freon bottle, a little squirt bottle of Freon on my vacuum system, and I really enjoyed it. It was a fantastic little bottle of Freon, and you squirt it on your vacuum system, and Freon, having a particular molecular weight, just loved going through cracks, so you could see cracks and leaks in your system, and I quite literally had my hand back onto the lab bench to pick up some Freon, and the lab assistant grabbed it and said, "It's now illegal." And I thought, I'll have to look at this, and began to discuss with a few people, and found, look, some of the logic isn't here. I've just sort of picked up the numbers before looking at the diagrams and the labels and things. And so I said, look, I think I can speak about this for a while. And this is before I had all this practice podcasting. Had a friend who arranged a preparation talk for the science show with Robin Williams. And so there was a studio in Canberra Northbourne Avenue and Impus Street up there, recording studio, and I produced what was a dreadful. I'd written out various things in a very long, complicated way, and nothing like I do at the moment. And I was going to come to my big point, and Robin Williams said, we're not going to listen to this anymore. What about the extra UV light hitting Antarctica, destroying the ecosystem? I said, look, I'm not so sure about that. I'm sure that's an effect, but, you know, so you're a climate denier. No, I'm not climate denier. I was cut off. And I suppose I haven't got a memory. I suppose that the take-home lesson I had was you can understand things, but communicating it is... an overall problem. People like to communicate before they really understand it. And so I'd sort of learnt my lesson there that it's you have to be in the right place and have the right skills to communicate early on. So I had that series of experiences and about ozone. And so I thought, this is a sleeping issue, but now I'm doing so much podcasting so many times, I thought, look, this is a time I've perhaps got the skills now to actually bring up some of the basic issues with ozone with an audience who's sort of used to me as a role of an explainer, and the people who are wanting a very well-produced, a flashy science show style explanation. They'll switch off, and so I've got my small audience of people out there who perhaps listen for long enough and have become acclimatized to me. Yes, we can hear some of my idiosyncrasies, which will put most people off, and can say, well, perhaps there are some really interesting points to put through. Now, I'm going to... cut this on several points. One of the things I do obviously want to do is talk about quantum physics, and there is, believe me, quantum physics involved in ozone and spades of it. But the first point I want to cover is the actual size of the ozone hole and the actual definition of an ozone hole. So let's go back to this idea that the ozone layer is 3 millimeters thick. It's got so there's a unit of ozone layer thickness to help us visualize it. So if at atmospheric level of atmosphere I had a layer of atmosphere, atmospheric pressure of 1 millimeter thick of pure ozone, that would be equal to 100 something called Dobson units. I don't think he actually called it in his original paper Dobson. It's someone from the beautiful pre-war, post-war Antarctic research who, I think with a few other people, discovered that there was probably a deficiency, a reduction in ozone. And in order to quantify it, he said we'll have these units, and these units are very imaginable. So if you talk about a concentration of parts per million kilometres out thick between starting in the stratosphere and going up, and we'll have a discussion of that. It's hard to believe, but these Dobson units, 100 units equals 1 millimetre of pure ozone. It's an equivalent layer of pure ozone. That's a fantastic way of describing it. Now, unfortunately, it's fantastic, very easy, and someone who just reads it and sort of skips over the fact that this is an analogy will lose it. And unfortunately, in some certain little pockets, people now believe that the ozone layer is a layer rather than necessarily a zone. A zone where it gently increases to a maximum and spreads off. So I don't know. Sort of the ozone layer would be a similar to, if you've ever been the old style abattoirs, they have a huge smell. So if you can actually walk downwind of it, you can start to smell it, and you can definitely smell ozone. And we'll have a small side of it after we go into this. So the more or less constant layer of ozone around the Earth, and we'll discuss how it's made, is 300 Dobsons thick. And I'd like you to have a guess out there in podcast land. If there's a hole, what is the level of Dobsons and thickness of ozone? How much? What is the ozone concentration in Antarctic? That is the South Pole, and there's a reason for why it's more common in the South Pole. The hole, what's the thickness associated in the South Pole? Given that we've got the word hole, so if you have a hole in a bucket, and the bucket's a plastic bucket, 3 millimeters thick, and the bucket has got a hole in it, what is the thickness of plastic to rate as a whole, defined as a whole? And and I think if you use the bucket analogy, or the common everyday analogy, because we're using it in an everyday term, the thickness of the bucket is, it's a hole, it's no thickness whatsoever, the water goes in it, but it just pours out. But the thing to note here is that the thickness of the hole in the ozone layer is 220. If it drops down to 220, so in your 3 millimeter bucket, the thickness of the plastic at the bottom, if that drops down to 2.2 millimeters, in both cases, we're going to define that arbitrarily as a hole. Now, that piece of message doesn't get out, that the actual ozone hole is actually an ozone thinning, would be a more correct thing, but ozone thinning wouldn't sell as many newspapers. Look, I'm all hail to science communicators who can actually pick the keywords to create the actual understanding here. But then I do have my problems. Now, majority of people will look at the pictures of the thickness of the ozone hole and notice, oh, if you look at the pictures, you've got a map of Antarctica, the world, and are looking from the underneath, it looks all fairly official. You notice that there's actually a mountain of ozone and then a hole, and it looks like a dark hole. It looks, what can I say, it looks like a hole with the colour scheme they've got. And the actual colour scheme is an unusual colouring scheme because there's a whole series of colours which aren't used. They're using blue or black as the at around 220, and then it goes up to pink again as you actually get much, much, much deeper and actually covers. They reuse some colours some way. And I don't know. That's a what I would call a theatrical colour palette to make the hole look more like a hole. Yeah, like the minimum darkest colour is at 220, and you get some more colour peach and more colours. It's more colourful if it goes down to 100. And I don't know whether it's a direct deception, but it is deceptive. So I ask you to go in and look at the whole colours and actually look at the colour palette, and you'll see it's there. Not that I was saying that in 89 when I was talking with Robin Williams. That was the major point I was making. I was trying to make a more subtle point, which I'll make at the end of here. So let's have a little bit of a talk about ozone. You can actually, one of the discoveries I found about ozone is that you can actually buy an ozone generator, which is a UV lamp, and air gets blown past and it produces a lot of ozone. So if you want to buy ozone, you just look up on the internet ozone generator, and it's this special lamp and it glows and creates ozone. And ozone itself is quite a toxic antibacterial material. For your ozone experience, you used to be able to smell ozone in the old TV sets, the high voltage of the old tubes, the TV sets would, and the old gramophones, with the old tubes and the old computers, you could smell the ozone. And this is the high voltage, the hot cathodes would produce radiation, and that radiation would be in the ultraviolet and would generate your own ozone. So the old TV sets have now been thrown out, and they are pretty old. You'd smell inside them, you'd smell a bit of cooking dust, and you'd also smell the ozone. But nowadays, the way to fill to get your ozone hit, so to speak, is actually put your finger about half a millimetre above a plasma ball. So it's not touching the plasma ball, but it's about half a millimetre above, and let the plasma find your finger. It's quite good. And then you run it for a while, and if you smell your finger gets infused with a small amount of ozone. So that's the way you can smell ozone. Ozone's O3. And essentially, let's start off in a bit of physics. That's going to go into quantum physics very, very soon. So, light. So there's three grades of light. Let's go to the UV first, and then we'll go into ozone production, because there's UVA, which ozone doesn't really stop. It hits the ground, and it's a sort of a soft UV, and it doesn't cause sunburn. it's not intense enough to cause sunburn. However, there is something, and it's a UVA, which happens over a greater period than the sunburn time, and it's something that you can get rid of UVA by actually putting sunscreen on. So why do you put sunscreen on for if you're not going to get sunburned? Well, UVA actually can actually penetrate the flesh more. It's a longer wavelength, and it's actually the main source of skin cancer, UVA. Then we move up to UVB, which is definitely screened out by the ozone layer. So if you have a large amount of ozone, if you're closer to the ground or live in cities which produce a lot of ozone, that all gets screened out, and that definitely does cause skin cancer. So if you're on a beach in the day where the sun can actually go straight down, we're going to talk about the sun going straight down, and the UV light's again reflected off the sand, you can, or the snow, you can get quite sunburnt. And that causes skin cancer, but it's not as penetrating. And then UVC is UV, which is not stopped by ozone, but it's actually stopped by nitrogen and oxygen, which is one of the things, is it definitely starts off producing you the oxygen atoms separate. So the it comes in, strikes the oxygen dissociates. Now, one of the things, if an atom falls apart rather than jumps up to an energy level, it falls apart, it falls around into a continuum. So the UVC is stopped, but it's stopped fairly high up, and so you get a production of nitrogen guards it off. So nitrogen actually protects it from the oxygen, and it's high up. I suppose that you get some oxygen atoms being produced at all levels as the UVC comes in, and these oxygen atoms are very reactive, and one of the things they do stick to is they like to stick to an oxygen molecule. Now, I'll have to go off because it's been years since I've looked at it, whether the oxygen atom is metastable, and we're going to have to talk a bit about metastable. So this is excited, but its electron shape is inside. The electron is the wrong shape to actually just radiate. This is one of the things that you can't access with your little classic drawing of an atom with the electrons as little flies flying around, say, a meatball. That's one thing you can't access, but if you think of it as a piece of origami or a piece of jelly, which is folded, it can't unfold. So your oxygen dissociates, breaks up into two, and those two oxygens atoms, if you're lucky, will go around a stick and make two ozones. Now, the ozone's O3. Now, in the simple view of things, O3 is a more flexible, more gently held together, so it can be broken apart again by ultraviolet light. Now, there's several things we have to talk about here, but let's follow this apart. And so one of the things is that if your ultraviolet light comes in, it breaks about the ozone, deposits its heat, and we're going to talk about that in a little while, and in doing so it produces an oxygen and an oxygen atom. Now, this means that ozone is this sunscreen which regenerates itself as UV hits itself. And that would be all very good. You've got a slow produce way to produce a little bit of it, and once you've got a little bit of it, that little bit stays there. So, but what in actual fact happens is that it produces not one but three oxygen atoms in a two-step process. So it's a bit like a chain reaction. So when the UV light comes in, it really starts to put its foot on the accelerator. And this is something which doesn't get through to the general public and the general story, because it involves quantum mechanics, metastable atoms and stuff like that. So one of the things is that when UV light hits it, it puts an extra amount of energy into ozone, and it produces an oxygen atom plus a metastable oxygen. So that metastable oxygen is not like your normal oxygen. It's oxygen with a twisted electron inside it, and it's twisted to such a geometry that electron twist can't snap back to the natural oxygen. So I think from 20 minutes to I think 3 hours, it's different metastable states. You can go in, your oxygen has an extra electron volt of energy going in. That's metastable oxygen. I've got the I think there's A and D state. I really can't remember. It's a long time ago. I sort of measured the I made metastable oxygen, I made ozone, I made metastable oxygen, and I pumped it through a system and actually measured the absorption of metastable oxygen by UV light. So this is one of the things, that one reaction channel which I definitely know about. And so I had a little microwave discharge, oxygen, pure oxygen, going up through a glass tube, a little microwave oven the size of your thumb wrapped around here with a tuner in it, and that would strike up a microwave discharge in a glow in my tube, and this would allow oxygen pressure to go up into the cell, and I'd be able to measure, switch it on and off, and measure something called metastable oxygen. So metastable oxygen is really important, A, because it's storing some of the UV light energy, and then when the next UV light comes across, it's easy picking oxygen, whereas the other oxygen doesn't break apart so easily with UV light. This is strongly affected by UV light. So there's the ozone layer, and above the ozone layer is the metastable oxygen layer generated by the ozone which is breaking apart, and that metastable oxygen layer showers oxygen atoms back in to the ozone layer, creating ozone as if there's no tomorrow. So that's a complicated set of reactions. Well, not complicated, but we're shielded by a metastable layer which is causing which supercharges our ozone layer. And when you come to think of it, what is the advantage of telling people that? Well, it sort of explains a story. They may never have asked. A simple person may just say, oh, light comes in, and just look at those reaction rates and say, right, you've shown me a series of non-chain reaction, non-explosive, non-population-building reactions, but I just trust you. Or you can get people a bit more curious. So there's reaction process of multiple UV light hitting ozone to produce not one but three. And now that metastable oxygen, there's a whole lot of other metastables, they hang around for hours and cause a lovely infrared glow. I think you might be able to see it. Some of it may be a little bit visible. A lovely glow in the surface of the Earth, and this is called a night glow, and this absolutely pours infrared radiation into all these big, beautiful ground-based telescopes. It varies as well, but again, look up night glow. I'm sure it's there. sky glow, night glow. This is the metastable glow. And the power of it, the battery power of it, is the UV light stored in the energy of these metastable molecules. And so that's an important point. I don't know how you put that into the education system, but it's a very important point. Now, we have the story of the mechanism of ozone, which we'll go into, which is probably a worthwhile thing. So in summary, so far we've discovered that the ozone hole reporting is, I don't want to call it a beat up, but people haven't done their homework and checked whether people have will just listen to it and walk away with the idea that there's a hole and no ozone, or a hole where there's 220 units of hole of ozone. My definition of a hole, people will not walk away and think that my new zero is 70% ozone. That they wouldn't know, and there's no testing or understanding of it. We've talked about now to understand ozone generation, you need UV light, and the UV light does a double punch and produces showers of oxygen atoms, which produce showers of ozone. So let's go into the mechanism. So what happens is the South Pole in the winter months is completely dark. There is no light hitting there whatsoever. So no UV light. Besides the ozone blowing in from the bright side, all that ozone will disappear. And indeed, every winter since forever, there's been a hole in the ozone layer. This is really dropping down due to the fact of no UV lights. The major creation of the hole in the ozone is the fact that there is no ultraviolet light, no sunlight hitting it. So that's an important point to get across. And so what happens is that hole will appear every year, and as the spring light bathes the area, it will repair itself. And so our hole is actually, in fact, a delay in repairing the hole that's always there. So it's really the best thing to say, it's a hangover hole. The hole is hanging over longer than it should be in spring. So the hole appears in spring. Well, no, the hole appears in winter and doesn't repair itself in spring. So we've got that particular point. Now let's look at the mechanism for the hole, and again, why it doesn't repair itself. And again, this is a story of CFCs. Now, but CFCs that your spray can comes out. Why does it have to, why does the spray can have to go when you release your piece of hairspray? Why doesn't it burn a hole directly above you in Sydney or Toronto or San Francisco or Madrid or Moscow or New Delhi? Why doesn't it work there? What is it special about Antarctica? Well, the story is a little bit more complicated. The CFCs, which are photograde into just chlorines and other very simple gas, which react, and it must react in a more complex way than some of the equations I've seen. There's got to be a few more for to explain what's going on. However, they quench the oxygen atoms and quench the ozone. They basically rip their way through the ozone. So as soon as you have Cl minus up there, it will start to rip it apart. But evidently there is something happening above us at the moment. And what's happening above us at the moment is that there's nitrous oxide and other smoke which is quenching the quenchers. So the quenchers are quenched normally. And in Antarctica, with the circumpolar vortex, it blows moisture up into the ozone layer area, creating high ice clouds. The high ice clouds act as a scrubber, and they scrub the smog and pollution out of the atmosphere, producing very pure air. And so only when you get very pure air do you get the release of the CFCs finally get released into the atmosphere. And so this is another explanation for why it's, why you get just a thinning in that area. So it's the delay in repair, and you've got this complex complex process going on. And my sort of general thing is that we should be very clear when we're explaining to people and actually test, did people understand the explanation as we want it, or have they, has someone, a third party, gone on saying, I want to sell newspapers, I want to have a career speaking to people, is the scientific process that we have for journals pretty much the same sort of scientific process that we would have for peer review? Is that peer review process going in our scientific communication? And in our scientific communication, are we satisfied that our general assumption that society can't comprehend quantum mechanical layers, that quantum mechanical layer, the night globe, quenching and quenching the quenches, are we sure they don't understand, or can we have different methodologies of trying? Is our search for a solution for the ozone hole, can we use some of that science to search for a way of talking through it? So now we know why the ozone hole, or the ozone reduction, or ozone hangover, which might be better, is in the southern hemisphere and in spring. But there's still a few more factors to think about, because whatever it is, there's less UV light going. Oh, there's more UV light hitting the ground in Antarctica for a few things. But at what point do we stop and say, well, let's look at the geometry? The sun in spring is just popping up against the horizon, and it's actually cutting through a lot more atmosphere to get to you. So if the sun's directly above you, UV light can actually get to you because it's very scatterable. So if the sun's on the horizon, sun, it's like a sunrise, sunset, it'll be slightly reddened because the UV and blue light are scattered out. Now, I've seen pictures of the sun in Antarctica, and one of the things that does strike you is that it's not like a normal sunrise. It looks there's not a lot of scattering there, and I don't have a full explanation of that, but there is a much greater depth of light, and you can do some calculations in your head or some visualizations in the head. So if you have atmosphere 10 times bigger than the size of your planet, the fact that the sun is above you or on the horizon doesn't really matter. So you can imagine two circles. You draw one circle and another tiny circle, a tenth of the size on the inside. The distance to the edge of the atmosphere going above is 9 units, and going out to the side is probably around 10 units if you're lucky. So there's not much difference if the atmosphere is thick, but comparatively the atmosphere is, say, 50 kilometres, roughly. It's roughly about 1% of the radius of the Earth. And so in that configuration, the actual thickness of the ozone layer that you're cutting through is, you're not cutting directly down, you're actually cutting across it. if that makes sense. And in terms of the actual ozone efficiency or light production efficiency, is not a stable thing. So in the equator, the light just hits the upper atmosphere. It's got, say, 100 kilometres of travel to go through, and then it hits the ground. But in Antarctica, if you're lucky, the actual light can actually hit or basically graze the ground and continue going off to space. You get actually a factor of two. And so you have these processes here which actually geometric processes which enhance ozone production and may in fact explain the I haven't done the maths of it. I'm sure I'd love to ask people who are actually experts in it as to actually the origin of the ozone excesses that are swirling around outside the ozone hole. Again, they're not huge excesses because the colouring is such to really amplify it and make the hole look like a hole. So there's a whole series of factors here coming through. Now, I could summarise them again, but I just expect you to go through the general things. There's a few disquiet points. Now, although I wasn't really committed to this, I felt somewhere in me said this is the point why I wanted to do the science show, in that I felt back in the late 80s that we had a responsibility of scientists to have a professional, unbiased, patient thing where we explained ad nauseum exactly what was going on to the best of our ability and tested it. That's what I felt that if we didn't do this, people could quite rightly, on the edges, create an anti-science viewpoint, discredit science, be able to poke holes in the argument, because the arguments did have holes in it. We were being a bit slovenly with it. And we could eventually, when the real big problem came along, which at that stage looked as though it was going to be global warming, and eventually within a few years it did actually turn up. People were looking at the carbon rise in the upper atmosphere and stuff like that, and it was sort of predicting if that really came along, we'd be a bit stuffed because we've used up. We would have had people come in and communicate without peer review, without some of the stops and discussions and some of the efforts. You know, there is a certain amount of effort to understand the implications of our technological world. We have the technological benefits, but we've also got the technological burdens to understand it at a more sophisticated rate. So if we dump that and we just grab the sensationalism and the look and the feel, well, it set us up for what? And I look, as much as I could describe it, the sort of Donald Trump. And look, there's no way that I knew exactly that Donald Trump would come along, but the general scenario here, that would be a significant risk to us. So here's we have what's now climate deniers, and I'm not making the argument now, but I did actually make the argument back then that we had responsibility to work out plans, strategically plan, that when we arrived at this point in time, we weren't in the situation we are at the moment, in which there's a whole series of poorly thought out explanations or poorly executed explanations in circulation, and it's restricting our ability to maintain scientific integrity. So that was not a prophecy or an observation. I didn't passionately believe it was just mechanical, sort of looking at the data at the time and what it actually meant, sort of like the Dobson units and at the time and the mechanisms at the time and what that meant. It meant something a bit different, and the real consequence that I could see was not the threat of the ozone depletion, but the depletion of credibility of science. This is not the credibility in terms of how much people believe you and think you're a great person. It's the how much they're going to invest, how much effort people are going to invest in doing it. So if we keep on making sort of like the fast food culture, we're sort of intellectually obese, so to speak, when we need to be a little bit more athletic. So that's Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss the ozone layer. And yes, indeed, quantum physics is a key to unpicking some of the story here and unpicking or see significance of including certain reaction rates or including certain levels of explanation. So when they put UV light goes to O2 plus O, goes to ozone. UV light plus ozone goes to that. It really should be O2 star, and O2 star plus UV goes to O. So it's O2 plus 2 UV goes to 3O. That's at least one important aspect. And the quenching of the quenching and the angular aspects of it all go to building the ozone story, something which is sophisticated, elegant, and worth thought. But it means that because we haven't done over the years, like the past 30 or 40 years, we haven't done our homework, we are in a problem now when we're trying to say, well, no, we really should shut down our coal-fired stations and replace it with a nuclear energy. That's Peter Hill. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science. It's a hard job, everybody.